word of thank you to many people for making this summit possible. First of all, to the nearly 350 delegates who joined us from over 30 countries, and including those of you who are still with us this afternoon. This has been, I hope, an inspiring summit. And as I indicated in my letter of welcome in the program, this summit comes at an extraordinarily timely period in the fight against HIV/AIDS, one in which we're wrestling with not whether, but how and to what degree and with what speed we intend to alter the course of the global epidemic. We've heard from a distinguished faculty that we can make this happen. So I'm hopeful that we each leave London in the next day or so enthusiastic and passionate about putting an end to this epidemic. IPAC's thanks as well to our partners, the British HIV Association, Public Health England, and UNAIDS. I'd like to single out two individuals who were extremely helpful in creating the conference program. Jane Anderson from Public Health England, former chair of BIVA and our partner last year as well, and David Asbo, the current chair of BIVA. Our thanks as well to our institutional commercial supporters, to our honorary chair, Brian Gazzard, also member of the IAPAC Board of Trustees, to distinguished faculty, and to our chairs, Ken Mayer and Julio Montaner, both of whom I think we all recognize as leaders in their respective fields. Certificates of attendance will be delivered to each of you via email, as well as an evaluation survey in the next 2 weeks. And I'd like to mention that the slides and audio recordings from the entire summit are available both on the IAPAC and BIVA websites. So with that, thank you once more. I turn it over to our distinguished chairs who will be chairing the panel, Can We End the HIV Epidemic in Our Lifetime? Thank you.
Thank you, Jose. And personally, it's been a great privilege to be working with Jose, IAPAC, and with Julio on this meeting. So we're now in the final stretch. So we have four wonderful panelists to address this major issue. I'm going to introduce the first two panelists because they're going to show slides in succession, and then Dr. Montaner is going to be handling the rest of the session. So our first speaker will be Dr. Deborah Birx, who is a renowned international expert in the field of HIV. She began her work in the U.S. military, led the vaccine research effort there, and is currently overseeing the CDC's Global AIDS Program. She'll be followed by Dr. Kevin Fenton, who has had a binational career, a distinguished career in public health here in the U.K. He led the CDC's AIDS effort for several years and now is back here in London, and he is the Director of Health and Wellbeing in Public Health England. So, Dr. Birx, please take it.
Thank you. And it's good that our ART retention is better than our retention to the end of the meeting. So this is just a big count. I think we're down by two-thirds. But I just I wanted to do something really briefly, and that's to bring up some of the Kenya data as well as the data that was released yesterday. So this is the new UNAIDS data that you all, I'm sure, have read carefully in the report last night. And importantly, over the last decade, the number of deaths and the number of new infections, the new infections being in the green, are down by a third in sub-Saharan Africa, and the number of deaths are down by 25%. If you look at prevalence and incidence, I think many of you remember the prevalence was about 5.8 a decade ago. It's now down to 4.7. And the incidence across the continent, modeled incidence, has halved. So, but it's not equal, and it's not equal across countries. So this is a graphic from the global report, and you can see that some of the countries have more than a 50% decline, shown in green. Some of the countries have less than a 50% decline, and some of the countries, like Uganda, have had this increase and a recent increase in new infections. So I always find when talking to ministries of health, it sometimes helps to match countries to really point out some of the differences. So if you look at Mozambique and Malawi, very similar epidemic in its peak, very similar in the number of, and in the black line is new infections, the red line is deaths out of the spectrum model. Very similar projections, but one country that has had a very different curve. These are both HIV-1C epidemics. They are both Very much similar in the HRH, the Human Resources for Health, and the makeup of the local clinics, and yet you can see one has had a dramatic difference. If you look at Kenya versus Uganda, again, this is an East Africa epidemic, so it's an ADC complex, unique recombinant epidemic, but very similar in the peak of the epidemic, but very different profiles in new infections and deaths between the two countries. And so you start to ask, well, how are these countries different? Remember, the host genetics are very much the same, the viral genetics are very much the same, but the outcome's very different. And this gets into this ecologic argument about what is responsible. Believe me, I still have very intense arguments with people about whether service delivery has had an impact or not, but those are really the primarily differences between the two countries is the coverage of services. So if you look at service delivery coverage, and this is again from the UNAIDS Global Report that was released yesterday, you can see there's very few countries now that are under 50% coverage. Southern Sudan and DRC and Nigeria leading that group, and this is PMTCT coverage. But you can see a large number of countries have very broad coverage for PMTCT. And this is adult treatment coverage, again, just reported. You can see Kenya's adult treatment coverage is 81%. Uganda's just became 70%. It was 50% up until last year, which would be responsible for the other data that you saw. And in similar with the other comparisons, you can see Nigeria's coverage is very poor, along with Mozambique, but Malawi's coverage is about twice what Mozambique's was the year before. So I'm showing you data that's not available yet, so please do not go back to the Minister of Health in Botswana and tell her that I presented their early Botswana AIDS indicator survey. But I wanted to show it to you because that was model data and this is true prevalence data. So you can see the green line is the shift in prevalence and the shift in much lower prevalence in the younger age groups. The actual increase in the 15 to 19-year-olds in prevalence, we believe, is due to their aggressive treatment, pediatric treatment over the last decade, and those children are now aging up. But you can see the green line is significantly different at all age groups with lower prevalence compared to 5 years ago and 5 years before that. If you look horizontally, because they're 5 years apart, you can see that there hasn't been large number of added incident cases between the age cohorts as they age up into the next prevalent group. We find this incredibly encouraging. Again, this is not modeled data, but door-to-door prevalence done as an AIDS indicator survey. Similar data from Kenya, and it's good to see Jono here because he really led this effort when he was in country. This is the AIDS indicator survey done in 2007 and 2012. Again, very clear data showing this large drop, a statistical decrease in prevalence in men, women as a whole, and in the urban versus rural areas, all showing this decline in prevalence. And if you look by age group, you can see that the number of new infections that are occurring in the younger age groups are all declining. And I think this is a very good sign for all of us that Kenya is on its way to creating an AIDS-free generation and having more control over their epidemic. Although, just like countries are all different, regions of the countries are different, and you can see that there's an area of continued high prevalence in Nyanza. And whereas many of the other areas have halved, including Coast, which had a lot of the key populations. HIV testing, this is very encouraging. The number of women reporting testing is 80%. The number of men, 63%. That's a significant increase from just 5 years previously. And 72% of the adult population have been tested by this door-to-door survey. The rates of HIV do continue to be very high among uncircumcised, and that's very prominent in the Nyanza province. And then we've been rolling out circumcision, but this gets into the issue about implementation. Great on paper, not always easy to implement, and you can see the coverage of circumcision is only 66%. In Rwanda. This I put in there because I really wanted to hammer this home. We do both CD4 and viral load testing during the AIDS indicator survey, and of those people on ART, 78% were virally suppressed, less than 1,000 copies. Another 9% were in the 1,000 to 10,000 copies, and only 11% were over 50,000. And this is, again, in a door-to-door survey. So instead of modeling prospectively, we asked the goals model groups to go back and model what they believe based on the data, and the changes in coverage was due to ART. And in their goals model, it came out to be 50% of the difference between if they had not had ART versus having ART, 50% of the declines were due to ability to have ART. So finally, I just wanted to end with, I think all countries are very different. They're different in the profile of the epidemic. They're different in the rural versus urban areas. But we are very concerned, and I think all of you are, about the continued epidemic in Nigeria and its fact that the adult new infections in Nigeria are only second to South Africa. But Nigeria passes all countries in the burden of new pediatric infections with very poor coverage of PMTCT and a very high burden of deaths, and ranks now number one in deaths from HIV. So in summary of what I take home from this incredible 3 days is comprehensive packages of prevention that have to be appropriate for the risk group, appropriate for the country, and appropriate for the epidemic. So this all has to be done within the very local context, that we need to provide really in-depth and breadth of messages. As providers, sometimes we leave out important facts. Sometimes we try to leave the client towards our way of thinking. But I think it's very important that we're completely honest, both with the client and the ministries of health. We have a lot of lessons learned from trying to roll out voluntary medical male circumcision, even though we knew it was highly effective and we were able to convince ministries of health it was highly effective. There was a disconnect between the communications and the rollout in the community. And so we've learned the same thing about medical assisted therapy within our drug using population, and we learned it in the B-plus rollout. Malawi is a stellar example, but not all countries have been able to achieve what Malawi has achieved. And it's very difficult to do all of this work without viral loads. Those of us who have been privileged to take care of patients for a number of decades have had to use viral load as an adherence monitor and as at our relationship with our patients all along throughout this epidemic. And to not have it in Africa is really crippling us in our ability to really discuss things with patients. I think the jury is still out. That if people have high viral load and the degree of chronic inflammation that occurs at the level of the lymph node despite lack of symptoms may have significant long-term effects. And we're a little bit ignoring about the chronic inflammation that occurs with people that have ongoing HIV infection, and we don't know what that would happen in those that have continued spikes of ongoing endemic other infectious diseases. So you have low-level inflammation that then spikes with high-level viral load, and we don't know what that does as far as immune destruction. So we shouldn't pretend to know that treatment of test and treat, of knowing as soon as you're found to be positive and put on therapy. We don't know that course because we don't know the impact of this chronic inflammation on people's health. And we know within cardiovascular disease and with rheumatologic diseases, it's a very bad thing. We all have some feeling that chronic inflammation must be a bad thing in some way, and that's why men take aspirin every day. But somehow we have to figure this out about chronic inflammation. And then we know there's barriers to access, but it's fluid and it's very community specific. We will have one community that is a village over from another community, an extraordinary high uptake of services, and it has to do with opinion leaders who stand up and say it's important in that community. And then our dialogue with the ministries of finance and ministries of health need to be done with the CBOs, NGOs, and the individuals, and so that the ministries are not only hearing from the donors, but hearing for all the relevant stakeholders. And we as donors have an obligation to try to bring those groups together and facilitate that dialogue. And then finally, I think we need clarity in the epidemic. You can see how important these AIDS indicator surveys are. We have to utilize tools as they become better, and this is a better tool. It gets us to impact and outcome, and we should be utilizing them in all of these countries. And finally, I think words matter, and I'm a little bit concerned about us talking about hotspots because I think it's stigmatizing. I think it's the last thing we want to do. It's too close to hot zone. People know that hot zones are bad. People will think that hotspots are bad, and I think we have to find a different terminology to discuss areas where there's increased or continuous epidemics or low-level or higher-level incidents compared to other areas in the country and figure out what that word is. And I really am relying on you all to come up with a better word than hotspots. I think we do have to define where the epidemic is, and we know that there are regional geographic areas that have more endemicity than others, but we have to think of a better term. So thank you.
So good afternoon, everyone. And again, thank you to the organizers for inviting me to give this final presentation reflection for the afternoon. I've been doing a lot of thinking about whether or not we can and will be able to end the epidemic within our lifetime. And in my presentation, I'm going to take a uniquely public health, programmatic, and policy perspective to that question, in part build upon the experience that I've had in managing, leading, and developing elimination and eradication programs for infectious diseases, both in the United States and here in Europe. So to begin with, I'm going to just quickly reflect on where we are with the epidemic. And I think part of answering this question really does require an honesty with where we are in our response, where we are with the assets that we have to deal with the epidemic, and what kind of leadership and infrastructure we will need to move forward if we truly are going to bring this epidemic to an end. So there's been a lot of progress that we've made in the fight against HIV/AIDS, and this meeting has reconfirmed not only our commitment, but many of the advances, whether it's our better understanding of disease pathogenesis and epidemiological transmission, whether it is the improvements in diagnostic tests, the range of prevention methods that we now have to address the epidemic, and of course, the role and effectiveness of highly active antiretroviral treatment as a key tool in addressing this epidemic. And clearly, one of the most exciting developments for those of us who have been working in prevention is the wide range of prevention tools that we now have at our disposal, as well as the tools which are likely to come on stream in the near future. It's also exciting that we're now beginning to look at and to talk about ways in which these prevention interventions might be combined, might be delivered, might be scaled to have the best impact on the epidemic. And I think this really gives us really good hope and good encouragement to begin thinking about the end game when it comes to the HIV epidemic, both in Western industrialized countries, but indeed around the world. But as I said at the beginning, part of answering the question on whether or not we'll bring an end to the epidemic within our lifetime requires that we're honest with where we're not doing particularly well in our response to the epidemic today. We know that there's still millions of people who are still living with HIV, and incidence, although declining, is still at an unacceptably high level. We know that there are real challenges when it comes to the coverage of the most effective prevention interventions, especially for those who are at greatest risk. For example, sex workers, injection drug users, men who have sex with men. We know that we have to do a much better job, whether in developed countries or in developing countries, in ensuring that we get the most effective tools to these populations. We know, again, that HIV incidence is stable or, in some instances, rising in certain countries. And we know that there are real issues with access to antiretroviral treatment for people living with HIV. And Debbie Burks, in her presentation, really illustrated the heterogeneity across sub-Saharan Africa with access to this, the most effective tool that we have in our toolkit. Throughout the course of the last 2 days, we've also been reflecting on the fact that the sustainability of our responses is in question, as many low-income countries are still almost entirely dependent on international aid to fund and to support their prevention, treatment, and care programs. And there are real challenges as we've passed through this economic decline of the sustainability of some of the most important programs in many of these countries. And finally, I think another challenge that we will have to face in the years ahead is as we're looking at an aging cohort of HIV-infected individuals, but also individuals who are acquiring HIV as they age, we're having to think about managing the chronic disease implications of the disease and the complications of HIV management in this fourth decade. So if we are going to end the epidemic in our lifetime, what will it require, and what sorts of conversations do we now need to have to ensure that we're preparing ourselves for this? And I would argue that there are three key things that we need to begin thinking about. In addition to having robust data, as Debbie has highlighted, I think any movement and any discussion about elimination or eradication has to be based on a realistic assessment of our track record with eliminating and eradicating other infectious diseases. And I would argue that we should be looking at some of these other elimination programs to learn what lessons we might gain as far as the acceptability, the feasibility, and the timing of elimination programs so that we can truly begin thinking about what are the true lessons that can be learned about promoting and thinking about an elimination of HIV. And as we've learned with many other infectious diseases, having an effective vaccine, having effective treatment, or even having a cure for that infectious disease may be necessary, but it certainly is not by itself sufficient for ending the epidemic, because if that was the case, we would not be grappling with so many other infectious diseases as we are today. So very quickly, I'd like to tell you the tale of two elimination programs that I had the privilege of running in the United States. The first was the syphilis elimination program. Many of you are aware of the epidemiology of syphilis, hyperendemic in the United States after the Second World War, in part driven by soldiers and sailors returning to the United States. Massive reductions in syphilis diagnoses throughout the 60s and in most of the 70s, in part because of effective treatments, better prevention programs being delivered, increases in the 70s with the liberalization of sexual behaviors and mores, and then more recently with the appearance of the HIV epidemic, dramatic declines in syphilis in the United States. So really a very heterogeneous epidemic pattern of syphilis in the United States over many years. In 1999, when syphilis was at its lowest rate in the United States, the CDC, with external partners and the U.S. Congress, decided that we would embark upon a syphilis elimination program. And syphilis elimination at that time was defined as having less than 1,000 cases of primary and secondary syphilis reported per year. Now, this was a great movement at that time, and as I said, it was very clear to clarify what exactly do we mean by disease elimination, and there were a variety of definitions which were used. We settled on a couple which are highlighted here, but again, the driver for thinking about elimination was the fact that rates were at historic lows, we had the restriction of syphilis to a limited number of geographic areas, and there were effective diagnostic and treatments which were available for syphilis. Disease eradication for syphilis was thought not to be appropriate at the time, in part because of the tremendous in-country flows that we had from high-prevalence countries, which would make complete permanent reduction to zero of syphilis unsustainable in the United States. So we set ourselves an elimination target. Now, there are many, many accomplishments of having the syphilis elimination program, and I've highlighted a few of them here. There was this reductions in disease incidence. We had tremendous increased investment as a result of the advocacy around elimination. There was increased awareness and knowledge about syphilis, better provider engagement on syphilis treatment. There was expanded access to STD care and improved partnerships on programs. But there are also real challenges as well, and I've highlighted a few here. Changing disease epidemiology, changing risk behaviors, especially among men who have sex with men, the syndemics of drug addiction and abuse, the interaction between syphilis and HIV, inadequate access to healthcare services and partner services, and again, even in the United States, at a time of relative plenty before the emergence of the global economic downturn. Now, many of you are familiar with the subsequent trajectory of syphilis in the United States. We did see a resurgence of syphilis in the U.S., largely confined initially to men who have sex with men. We continue to see declines in syphilis occurring in women, and we've moved towards a virtual elimination of congenital syphilis in the U.S., in part because of very strong programs of early screening and treatment of pregnant women with syphilis. But this really illustrates some of the real challenges that we had and experienced with the syphilis elimination program. And some of the key lessons learned are highlighted here, the importance of not just having a vertical elimination program, but integrating it as part of the broader STD and HIV prevention programmatic response, ensuring that there was good surveillance, because surveillance is at the core and the bedrock of an effective elimination program, ensuring that you're flexible and being able to respond to new challenges that might appear as the epidemic becomes more concentrated, especially among those who have poor access to curative services or who are less likely to be in touch with preventive services. Adopting a far more holistic response, moving away from only thinking about one infectious disease and trying to eliminate that disease, but thinking about the context and the systems which need to support it. And of course, the bedrock of providing good STD services was actually critical for the syphilis elimination program. Now, the second example I'm going to quickly review is the TB elimination in the United States. Again, very much so, we saw improved economic conditions, development of effective drugs for TB, and TB diagnosis had fallen tremendously during the 1980s, and therefore it was thought that maybe this was an opportunity for us to push towards TB elimination in the United States. Again, we see a very encouraging disease trajectory for reported TB cases in the United States. And the TB elimination program was launched in 1989. And almost immediately after the announcement of the TB elimination program, diagnoses of TB increased in the United States. And this was largely driven by the onset of the HIV epidemic, increases in TB cases, especially among foreign-born persons, outbreaks in congregate settings, for example, hospitals, correctional settings, etc., and of course delays in recognizing the appearance and the transmission of drug-resistant TB. Again, this provides, I hope, a little bit of realism as we set our ambitions with respect to setting elimination programs. One of the other key features of the TB elimination program in the US was soon after announcing the TB elimination program, we had substantial cuts in TB funding and subsequent deterioration in TB programs nationally. So that complicated the programmatic response to this program. Again, there are some key lessons learned from TB elimination. Global TB epidemic remain an important source of new cases in the United States. So as we're thinking about elimination in country, it's important to understand population movement as well as the epidemic disease transmission dynamics. Important to ensure that you continue to invest in better diagnosis, better screening tests, and better programmatic response. Thinking about the healthcare system and the infrastructure that is necessary for a robust response, and of course, investing in new diagnostic tools, vaccines, etc., are important. So in closing, I think there are some key lessons that we need to learn from elimination programs, and just highlighting here that we have to be honest about our epidemiology and understanding the epidemics and what are their determinants. We know for many elimination programs, they're often announced when disease is at a incidence is at its lowest or declining trends, but we have to ensure that there's effective treatment, diagnostic tools, and infrastructure in place. I cannot underscore the importance of leadership. Good leadership, sustained leadership, and funding is necessary to support broad-based efforts for elimination programs. Planning is critical. For both syphilis and for TB, there are plans which are developed at national level, regional, and state level to help drive both investments for elimination and to prioritize those investments. Prioritization is critical because programs need to ensure that there is effective implementation of the highest priority activities. And one of the benefits of both the syphilis and the TB elimination program was the removal of a lot of variation across the country in what people are doing, but really asking colleagues to focus on the most important interventions and rallying the entire country in one direction to move towards elimination. Clearly, with elimination programs, being responsive is critical because the epidemics are going to evolve, and it's really important that the infrastructure is in place to be responsive to that evolution. Partnerships are critically key. Onward research is important. And finally, ensuring that there's a sustainable endgame strategy that can really help to guide what you're doing in this time of lower incidence. So in closing, I think what I really wanted to do today was really just to acknowledge the progress that we've made with the global response to HIV. And I think it's really important for us to begin having these conversations about ending HIV in our lifetime. And it may be that we won't end the epidemic overall, but we may focus on specific areas of the epidemic that we can make gains. For example, eliminating mother-to-child transmission of HIV or eliminating transmission of HIV among injecting drug users. Lessons from control and elimination programs from other infectious diseases must be taken into account. And I think from my perspective, it leads me to be both ambitious, but to be pragmatic and to be humble about how we begin to talk about elimination of HIV. Underpinning all of this has to be leadership, and it has to be at the global and at the national level. You need focus, sufficient and sustained resources, robust monitoring systems, and special needs attention have to be placed on the most marginalized. And then finally, even if we don't achieve elimination, as we saw for both syphilis and TB, the energy, the passion, the focus, and the dedication that elimination efforts bring and can help with our general prevention programs, I think, can really help to accelerate our ambitions in this space. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah and Kevin, for the very encouraging but also sobering remarks. We're going to ask Noreen Kaliba, who is from Uganda. She's a physiotherapist and an educator, and she's a co-founder of the AIDS group, the AIDS Support Organization, or TASO. She is currently also a program development advisor for the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, and to Alan Whiteside, who is the founder and director of the Health Economics and HIV/AIDS Research Division, HERD, at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, to give us their closing remarks. Noreen, if you don't mind.
Thank you. I just want to begin with a small disclaimer that I do not work with UNAIDS anymore. I did and left at the beginning of 2006. I served my 10 years. I enjoyed it tremendously, but I also learned lessons that are very useful for the next conference. I also wanted to begin my interaction with you because this is a room full of people who care, men and women who are self-identified carers. So I wanted to lead you in collectively expressing our solidarity with the people and the government of Kenya and the global community on the tragic events, the tragic deaths and suffering that has been brought about in the last 4 days and while we're here. We express our collective solidarity with the families, those that have lost loved ones, but also we believe that those among us who are from the region will be going back home to begin accompanying and caring for those who have been involved in this atrocity. So I thought we shouldn't miss an opportunity to put that on record. Having been, you know, one of the joys of living and life is that you are there when things are beginning, when hopes are being expressed, when passions are being ignited, and then you are there to witness and be like I am today here, how far we have come, how much has changed, but also how much has remained unchanged completely. So as I went and as I listened and I interacted during this conference, I asked myself, 26 years ago, when my late husband Christopher was diagnosed with AIDS in this very country. So I think for me, even being here is like being on a pilgrimage, because my husband was diagnosed at Castle Hill Hospital. And before he went back home, just before he died, he received excellent care on the hands of the people of this country. So I pay great tribute to the carers in this country. And that, of course, brought me out of the physiotherapy, mainstream physiotherapy, onto the front line of activism to try and change the face and the experiences of persons and families that are affected by this disease. And thus, it was through that process that TASO was founded. So I ask myself, what is it that we, in 1986, ignited and relied on that we hoped would contribute to the answer to the question whether or not we are going to be able to defeat HIV in our lifetime? The question is, whose lifetime are we talking about? Because in this room, we are kind of a range of generations. But I wanted to answer that question from the perspective of a group of young adolescent children who danced for me just before I left my country to go to the airport to come to this conference. This was a group of adolescents born with HIV and having been cared for. They were born at a time when we all, I think, collectively believed that a child born in Africa with HIV does not live long enough to see their fifth birthday. Now, these young men and women who danced for me and sang for me were adolescents. And many of them had finished were finishing high school, and some of the songs they were singing to me were saying, we are going to finish school, we are going to get married, and we will invite you, Jaja. That's the name I've been given on the African continent. Jaja means grandma. We will invite you to our wedding. We are going to have children, and our children will not have HIV. I was very touched by that. So when we say, are we going to defeat HIV during our lifetime? I want to speak from the perspective of that group of adolescents. And my answer to you, and I think, should be a resounding yes. Yes, we can. But a lot of gaps have been identified during this conference. And I felt that reflecting from the gaps that did not exist when we started our movement in 1986, I think some of those gaps have been narrowed. The first gap was the gap of global solidarity. We in Africa were hiding behind the screen saying that HIV and AIDS was a white homosexual disease for men in San Francisco. But we soon began a movement that resulted in our presence here today and the demonstration we have seen today of global solidarity. I think that one is a key sign that as a global community, we can defeat HIV because we have solidarity. The other very important movement that shows us is the science that we have had during this conference. I think science has taken us very far, and I think we have hope and expectation that will go even further. But there is a caution that was highlighted by a great man, Jonathan Mann, and picked up by Peter Piot, and continues to be propelled by Michel Sidibe. And that is, we, while we put our hope and expectation in science, we should not expect a quick scientific fix. I think that caution, I think we are all aware. A quick scientific fix to this pandemic is not a viable option. But despite that, as a global community, we continue to work in a pendular fashion. Every time there is what you could call a developmental scientific find, we communicate, we program, and swing in that direction, and totally forget that we should not be doing that. And I just wanted to raise that issue here and say, we should stop that. If we don't stop clamoring for whatever scientific advance that comes and forgetting all the others, we will never get where we need to get. We will never defeat HIV. And a particular point in this direction, when we agreed to promote treatment as prevention, we agreed that we would promote treatment to prevent morbidity, to prevent mortality, and to prevent transmission of HIV. We agreed that we would do those three together. And we would promote and advocate for the three together. Increasingly, when you look at country programming, we are programming only to promote prevention of transmission. We don't equitably promote positive health, dignity, and hope. When we started our efforts in Tasso, hope was a commodity that we spoke about, but many people did not understand. Because, of course, at that time, there was no treatment. But we say that hope is a critical element of survival. I just want to appeal to us, because we are carers, in the language that we use in our communication, when we speak about treatment for prevention, we should not forget to promote hope. Because without hope, without dignity, or those people who know their status, we will never be able to use treatment for prevention. So we shouldn't forget about the two, preventing mobility and dignity, improving dignity, and enabling people to feel that they are making a contribution, not because they are the tool of preventing transmission, but because they are promoting a solidarity. The other point, the last point, I think, point I wanted to make is a point about language. Language has always been one element in our crusade that either breaks or makes. In our endeavors to promote treatment for prevention, and in our haste, again, in our pendular swing, in the way we operate, we speak about test and treat. We agree to do that, to use that language. But in agreeing to do that, we dropped counseling. We dropped words like care. And as a result, you find in some countries, the programming of test and treat is about test. It's just about the technological test and the technological treat. The counseling, the accompaniment has no place in this array of pendular swing. And there are, subsequently, the funding that is being made available in many countries that I know does not pick up what we call the soft bits that accompany the test and treat. And as a result, we are not getting what we should get, what we wanted. Stigma has been mentioned during this conference, but we haven't really had opportunity to hear a paper or a poster which has specifically demonstrated what efforts have been taken alongside the test and treat efforts to address stigma. We know that many countries have identified and developed their stigma indexes, but I also know from my own country, Uganda, that there is no funding that has been agreed, made available, for the stigma index to be utilized at community level to stimulate discussion and open that process to address stigma. Equally, no funding is available for efforts, especially on the African continent, to address sensitive issues of persons in same-sex relationships. Commercial sex workers, all those people that have been identified in this conference that are falling between cracks. And I feel that this list, and I can go on, but I think the chair won't let me, this list of missed opportunities are the bottlenecks that we have to overcome in order to ensure that we defeat AIDS in at least in my lifetime. Thank you.
Let me just say that we hope you're going to be very busy going to a lot of weddings.
Yes.
Alan.
I'm going to stand up. So I wrote my first paper on HIV in 1987. Seems like a very long time ago. I watched the data as the epidemic took hold in South Africa and in Swaziland. When we did our first survey in Swaziland, only 4% of antenatal attenders were infected. Today it's 30%. I lived through the Mbeki era in South Africa, and I sat on that stupid panel. We weren't stupid, the panel. The reason we were there was stupid. Well, actually, half of them were very stupid. The so-called dissidents, who mostly came from West Coast, and it's such an delight to see Julio is an honorable exception to the West Coast insanities that we were faced with
from Duisburg and the people from Perth in Australia. And I've watched friends and staff die. And it's been quite miserable. But the last 2 days has been really encouraging, and I'm really delighted to have been here. So I want to do this last statement with 3 points and one aside. And the 3 points are around some of the tensions and the framings that we might look at in this epidemic. So the first point is the tension or the framing around long-term and short-term. And I think that here we have a real tension because we operate in environments where we work with a one-year budget or a two-year plan or a five-year strategy. But this epidemic isn't going to be dealt in those frameworks. For the adolescents that Noreen was talking about, we're talking about maybe 60, 70 years. In the absence of a cure, we need to be looking long-term, and we need to free ourselves from the short-term nature of governments and budgets. And that's the first tension and thing that I think we need to be looking at. The second tension that I think I felt and a framing that I believe we could be well placed to look at is the difference between healthcare providers and patients, between them and us, between the doers and the done to. And I was so delighted to see a slide that mentioned one of the gurus of innovation, which is Everett Rogers, a 1962 publication. And I'm reminded of Illich, Medical Nemesis, somebody better known, I think many of you may know his book, Deschooling Society. But certainly we need to think in these terms. We need to bring the anthropologists and the sociologists back into the room. The third tension and framing that I think we need and it would behoove us to look at is around aspiration and reality. The difference between what we want to do and what we can afford to do. And I totally agree that we need to push the envelope and make sure that what's in the envelope is better used. But before I started working on HIV, before I went to the University of Natal, I worked in the Ministry of Finance in Botswana. And let me tell you, finance trumps health in every meeting. Finance holds the cards. Finance tells you what you can do and what you can't do. And they trump all other ministries. So I think we need to be aware of this, and we need to be aware of the need to be better advocates. And I think I've heard enough in the last 2.5 days to believe that the material is there. What we need help with is the packaging of it. Okay, I said there were 3 points. I'm going to come back to those because I think there are ways forward on each of those. But let me just mention the aside. And the aside is this. I heard a number of times over the course of this 2.5 days people saying, and we had this data and we couldn't get it published. And that's a real concern. How much cutting-edge science hasn't got into journals when it should have and should have made a big difference? And I think it's really important that we ask ourselves what's not getting published as well as what is getting published. Because I haven't heard that at a scientific meeting before. And I think it was honest and open of the scientists who presented that to say that. And it troubles me that it was said and that it is so clearly true. Okay, so I gave you the three things, the three tensions that I believe we need to be thinking of. Short-term, long-term, healthcare providers and healthcare patients, aspirations and reality. What are some of the ways forward? I don't have grand ideas about how we deal with each of these. But what I would ask you to do is try and personalize them to yourselves, because ultimately it's all about me. So how can we think about these things in personal terms? Well, let's talk about short-term, long-term. Most people in this room are parents. When you have a child, you make a long-term commitment. I thought it was 18 years. I'm beginning to discover it's rather longer. So maybe we need to take some of our personal experiences and start putting them into our professional experiences in terms of the long game that we need to be playing to end AIDS. What about patients and providers and this dichotomy that we have here? Well, again, I think that we can all learn from our own personal experiences. I happen to know that Julio had a bicycle accident in Vancouver, and I would guess that he wasn't the best patient. But if I look around this room, there are those of us who are on medication, not just for HIV, but for diabetes, for hypertension, statins, aspirins that we should be taking. And I think we need to personalize our own experiences as we look at people who are required to take antiretroviral therapy, whether it be for their health or whether it be for prevention. And that's maybe something we can start thinking about. And then finally, on the budget. Again, I think if we personalize from they won't give us the money to how do we work with our own money, there may be help in trying to plan for a long game in HIV. We all make choices with what we have. We have bank managers, and I'm afraid the bank manager trumps the hairstylist, or if you have one, a bookie. And we need to think in terms of managing how we manage our own budgets in how we act with the money that we are given to deal with this epidemic. So there are three areas where I think we could learn and work forward, looking at the long term and the short term, us as patients and providers, and how we might budget. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alan. And for the record, my family doctor is in the audience, and she will attest that I took all the medications. I want to close by simply thanking IAPAC and Jose for the tremendous amount of work that they put on bringing us together. This is an area that we all recognize is extremely important, and it can potentially make a dramatic contribution to the control of HIV and AIDS globally. I look forward to continue to work with you to ensure that we do the best job possible. Thank you very much, and have a safe trip.